The Google Podcast app is going away in April. Right now, I want you to take a look at the podcast app you're using right now. Maybe it's time for a new one. Check out podcastapps.com and try a new one for free right now. That's podcastapps.com.
I'm a queer woman on the masculine of center spectrum. For so long, I resisted the butch label because of internalized shame and homophobia. I considered myself soft butch and androgynous, something a little smoother around the edges. But then I realized butch can be all of those things. Butch is bikers with tattoos and boyish girls in bow ties. Butch is handsome and beautiful. And even though I'm not 100% comfortable with my body, who is, I'm the most confident I've ever been. I would love to write an essay for Ravishly about embracing my butchness, because Ravishly magnifies marginalized voices, and I believe this topic is important and relevant, not just to me and others like me, but to our culture as a whole. Thank you for the opportunity, Bailey Jones.
Hi, I'm Allison Langer, and this is Writing Class Radio. You'll hear true personal stories and learn a little bit about how to write your own stories.
I'm Andrea Askowitz. Together, we produce this podcast, which is equal parts heart and art. By heart, we mean the truth in a story. By art, we mean the craft of writing. No matter what's going on in our lives, Writing Class is where we tell the truth. It's where we work out our shit. There's no place in the world like Writing Class, and we want to bring you in. Today on our show, we're talking about pitching to publications. We're talking about what to include in a query letter and all the homework you need to do before you pitch to an editor. The voice you heard at the beginning of this episode is Bailey Jones, and that was her pitch to Aaron Carr, the editor of Ravishly, an online publication that celebrates the mess of being human. On this episode, Alice and I speak with Aaron Carr about what it was like to receive that pitch, as well as why she chose Bailey's story for publication. Aaron will also discuss the basic how-tos for submitting stories for Ravishly. Her advice is useful for anyone hoping to pitch a story to any publication. At the end of the show, you'll hear the story Bailey wrote for Ravishly. So stay tuned.
Aaron Carr has been managing editor at Ravishly since 2017. Ravishly gets about 500,000 to 750,000 readers a month.
Damn!
Aaron has a book coming out in January 2020. The title of the book is Heroin, and it's a memoir about her journey with heroin addiction. Aaron has a weekly advice column on Ravishly called Ask Aaron. In addition to managing all the writers and editorial staff at Ravishly, she's in charge of reviewing all the pitches and submissions that come in, and she gets a ton.
It varies from week to week, but I get over 100 a week. And if I do a pitch call for something, then I'll get a deluge of pitches. But that's when I'm like really prepared, like I've set aside the time. Either on Twitter, or sometimes I'll send an email out to all of our writers. I don't do them that often just because of the volume of pitches that I get, and we're a small staff. So it's only if I'm looking for something specific. I have a flagging and filing system. As things come in, pitches get a certain flag color. If I've replied to someone and I'm waiting for a reply, it'll get a flagged color. I have different flag colors for different types of emails. And as soon as an email is handled, it either gets deleted or filed. But, you know, the amount of pitches that you have to go through is so astronomical that it can take a minute to get to. Organization is like, it's really part of my own self-care and mental health regimen, because when I'm not organized about something, I feel paralyzed and overwhelmed and anxious. And I found that if I try and put like an organizational system in place for whatever it is, like whether it's parenting or, you know, my social life or my own writing career or my role as an editor, that I just can handle life better and I'm happier. So that's sort of why I've forced myself to do it. I I try to get back to people within a week, but it's generally anywhere from a week to 2 weeks. I don't mind if people follow up with me. And if it's something that, like, if somebody follows up with me and they say, hey, have you had a chance to look at my pitch? It will get my attention. And if I have a minute to look at the pitch right then, I will. But if somebody has pasted like an entire submission, not just a pitch, into the email, I don't want to, you know, I want to be able to at least give it a couple minutes of reading. At Ravishly, for us specifically, we focus on like four main verticals. Bodies, which includes like body positivity, physical health, illness, invisible, you know, disabilities, and all of that kind of stuff, right? And then relationships, which is sex and love. Families, which includes all types of family relationships, but mostly parenting. And then minds, which includes mental health, self-care, addiction and recovery, those sorts of eating disorders, those sorts of topics.
You heard Bailey Jones's pitch at the start of the show. We asked Erin, what about that pitch stood out for her?
She immediately told me who she was and what her pitch was, and it was a unique pitch. I mean, here's the thing is that, yes, you can write like, I write a lot, like for me as a writer, I write a lot about the same topics over and over and over again. So if I'm going to pitch to a specific publication, I try and see, okay, like what's a good angle that I haven't written about before, or what new way can I write about it for this publication? And then go look at the I always ask people to go look at what we've published. You can scroll through. We have sort of one of those continual scrolls on our front page. You can keep going back through, you know, the last few months, or you can search for keywords on a website like ours and see like, what have we, so if you're pitching something on, I don't know, body positivity, then you go and look, what have we published in the last 6 months on body positivity? Because I get a lot of the same pitch over and over and over again. And it's not that it's a bad pitch. It's just that it's not anything new. And I don't want to publish the same article over and over. I'm not a perfect pitcher, but I've certainly learned a lot about pitching from taking pitches. Again, like in Baylia's pitch for that article, she told me who she was. She had a good strong link to something she had written recently that was co-related but a different angle, and had her social media handles in her signature. I can't tell you how helpful that is as an editor, because if it's a writer that I don't know, especially if it's a writer that maybe doesn't have a lot of clips, if I go onto their Twitter or their Instagram, I get an idea of who they are and their brand as a writer. Editors do look at that. At least we do it Ravishly. Her writing sample was really good when I clicked on the link. It was a good, clean article. It was at BuzzFeed. It was, you know, it was a good clip. And her email was succinct. That was like another thing. And I liked this idea that she brought about embracing the two sides of her identity, right? Because she identifies as a woman, and she has this idea of this like feminine, like embracing both the butch aspect of her identity and her femininity. That was interesting. And so that was really what hooked me.
So we asked Erin if she prefers people send a finished essay or a pitch.
I don't really care, but if you're going to hand in a submission, then also put a pitch in the beginning of the email. So I think, who are you? What do you want to write about? Why should you be the person to write about it? And then if you have the submission, either put it in the email or attach a Word doc. I know that in general, a lot of places, I think the New York Times, they only will look at it if it's pasted into the body of the email. So in general, I'll tell writers, do both. Like, just put it in the body of the email and attach a Word doc just to cover your bases. And then a couple of links to previously published articles. If it's a new writer and they don't have a lot of work, I say like get a blog going and put some stuff up on your blog, because then at least I can see something that you've written that's online. If it's somebody who doesn't have any clips, let's say, or has just a couple clips on their own blog, it has to be a really phenomenal pitch or a completed submission so I can really see what the whole thing is. If somebody hands something in and I need edits, what I'll do is I'll come back to them and ask for, you know, whatever sort of changes I'm seeing, whether it's I want them to narrow the focus into one area, or to I have a suggestion, why don't you try starting the essay or article from this point and then coming back to, you know, point A, those kinds of things. The majority of time, I usually only have to go to someone with one round of edits. There are people that I have gone back and forth with, and sometimes it ended up with like a, you know, an article or essay that was just fantastic. Sometimes, there are people that I've gone back and forth with, and it wasn't coming together. Had a writer where I sent a couple of small edits to. They weren't even like major things, just sort of like, can you elaborate a little on this? And they emailed me back and said that they didn't want to make any changes and they were withdrawing their submission. So I was like, all right, that's less work for me. I get a lot of emails where someone says, like, these are the things I write about. Hire me. I don't have the time to investigate someone's entire writing portfolio and decide what they should write for us. I really need people to come with a pitch. But I get that a lot. I get a lot of times, like, I'd love to write for you. What can I write for you? Which I appreciate the sentiment, but it's not helpful. I certainly had so many people, like, they're doing multiple submissions, so they've called me, like, the wrong publication. Or like, they've said, like, oh, you know, I love what you do at Cosmopolitan, whatever. Writers, gets a numbers game too. I've had, you know, all of us as writers have had a million rejections, and
you've rejected me.
I have. I'm so sorry.
And it's probably going to happen again for me. Many times.
Well, what's really funny is that the week before I got my book deal, I had submitted something to a publication, and the editor sent me a very mean rejection, and they said,
oh God.
They said this was better left for my diary, and that it just wasn't a very interesting story. And a week later, I got my book deal at HarperCollins. I was like, okay. The title of the book is Heroin, and it's a memoir about my journey with heroin addiction. I was a heroin addict as a very young teenager, started at age 13, and then stopped, you know, finally was able to stop using when I got pregnant with my first son when I was 28. Realize how important it is that we do this, because it really makes people feel less alone. And that's sort of our tagline at Ravishly: life is easier when you're not alone. And that's sort of been my driving motto as a writer and as an editor. I feel like everything that I do, I want it to make people feel less alone. And I think that's a really good place to come from when we tell stories.
Start with how I broke every single rule and suggestion when I first submitted to Ravishly. Oh my God, it is a miracle she ever chose my story.
I told you not to mention that because, first of all, you got rejected the first time you submitted to Ravishly. And second of all, you just got totally lucky. And I don't think it's cute to brag about not following instructions.
So now I understand not to send, oh, here's this. It has to have, like, you know, a little bit of a query to it. Even if it's not a pitch, the submission has to have, like, a sentence or two about what the story's about, right? I get that now. But, yeah, thankfully she didn't just, like, delete my email and never talk to me again, because I would have been like, fuck, another rejection? Yeah. When she was on, when we were interviewing her and she said all this, I was, like, shrinking in my chair. I was like, oh, God, I fucked everything up.
Yeah. Yeah, I learned a lot from listening to Erin. Yeah. So from now on, I always include Writing Class Radio, link to Writing Class Radio, and a link to AndreaAskowitz.com. I didn't do that before.
Yeah. I didn't know that was necessary. I didn't know people were checking. I thought they looked at your story, yes or no.
Right. But they want to know that you have cred.
And what about that flag strategy? We've totally incorporated that now since, you know, with our submissions that we get for our podcast. It's awesome.
Yeah. I learned so much about not only how to be an how to pitch as a writer, but also how to organize as a publication.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We should shut up because I know that I want to get to Bailey's story.
When we come back, you'll hear the story Bailey wrote for Ravishly. Back after the break.
We're back. This is Allison, and you're listening to Writing Class Radio. Today's episode is about creating the pitch that will get your hard work published. You just heard Erin Carr, managing editor at Ravishly, talk about what it takes for a pitch to become a published story on her magazine. Up next, we'll hear a story from one of the pitchees she received.
Pitchees.
Pitcher? Pitchee.
Pitcher.
She's a pitcher.
Yeah.
All right. Here's Bailey with her story, Butch is Beautiful.
As a tomboy in the 90s, I had no real concept of gender. I shadowed my four older brothers and numerous boy cousins that lived nearby. I liked whatever they liked. We rode our bikes, climbed trees, and played football until the streetlights buzzed on. On Monday nights, we watched WWE Raw, and on the weekends, we rented movies like Bride of Chucky and American Pie from Blockbuster. I dressed in their baggy hand-me-downs, wore backward hats or beanies, and often got mistaken for a boy. My mom and my grandma, who we call Momma, are the two prominent female figures in my life. They only wear skirts or dresses for special occasions. More often, they wear pants. They hardly wear makeup. Momma has cropped silver hair, and my mom's wavy blonde hair has never breached her shoulders. The Southern pageantry stereotype, gaudy bows, rhinestones, big hair, doesn't exist in my family. I wasn't aware of my femininity, or lack thereof, until middle school. I guess everyone assumed that I would grow out of being a tomboy as soon as I hit puberty. When I didn't, many family members tried to nudge me in a new direction. My Christmas list included pocket knives and shotguns. Instead, I got makeup kits and a purse. Admittedly, it was a camouflage purse. After someone stole my blue Walmart bike, my parents replaced it with the same model, in pink. My brothers, who shaved their legs for track, berated me if I had visible hair on my underarms. "You're a girl," they said. "Act like it." My family attempted to enforce gender roles they themselves didn't follow. I was confused. Why was I expected to suddenly change everything about myself when it wasn't an issue before? Even more bewildering, all the girls around me did change. It seemed like they had been handed the guide to being a teenage girl, and my copy got lost in the mail. My cousin Kayla, a tomboy like me growing up, stopped playing football with us one day and started cheerleading on the sidelines. Girls at school underwent similar transformations. In sixth grade, my friends stuffed their bras, flat ironed their hair, shaved their eyebrows, sometimes completely, and plastered their faces with gobs of makeup. I tried to be like them. I let them make me over and dress me up. I toted around my camo purse stuffed with makeup I didn't know how to use. What was I missing? Surely everyone else was lying or pretending. But as more and more people pointed out my wrongness, I realized that I was the problem. Questioning my sexuality during the same time only exacerbated my self-hatred. This was a small town in the South, and being gay equaled eternal hellfire. People who openly hated me claimed they did so out of love. I was a sinner, a perversion, an ugly, unlovable boy-girl butch dyke, and I internalized all of my oddities. I could talk about the shame that bubbled inside of me, the looks of disgust that followed me around, the constant string of personal questions. Are you a lesbian? Are you a boy or a girl? I could talk about the emotional abuse people inflicted on me, the physical violence I inflicted on myself, like cutting the body that had betrayed me. But I'd rather talk about a girl with big brown eyes who's the opposite of me. She wears floral dresses and fits society's standard of female beauty. When she was 14, she looked at the town lesbian in an oversized polo and a My Chemical Romance beanie and made her feel beautiful. She kissed me in a tent in her backyard and married me 5 years later. Being together in our town wasn't easy, but we had each other and the L Word, a show that taught us how to be gay, even though it got half of it wrong. I want to talk about my mama, who brought me back to school shopping one year, and while we were browsing the girls' section, I shuffled and mumbled, "Actually, mama, I'd rather check out the boys' clothes." She said okay, and told me to lead the way. That year, my mom let me pick out a black pinstripe jacket for my 11th grade winter formal instead of a dress. I want to talk about transferring to a more accepting and liberal high school, running for prom king because I wanted to push boundaries, and actually winning. When I chopped off my hair, stopped wearing hats, and glimmered with confidence because haircuts change lives. The first time I fastened a bow tie and looked in the mirror. Discovering other women who look and dress like me and feeling less alone. Every time a stranger compliments my style on the street, which is something I never thought would happen. Embracing butchness is a struggle, but these small moments have helped me undo years of insecurity. In terms of self-acceptance, I'm not where I want to be, but I'm getting closer and closer each day. I used to think I had to choose a side. If I wasn't what a girl was supposed to be, I would be what a boy was supposed to be. But that's bullshit. I can be masculine in pink and feminine in a suit. I can be both and neither. I can be me.
Bailey is a freelance writer and high school teacher living in Houston with her wife.
The one with the big brown eyes.
I know, that was so sweet. I liked Mama.
Yeah.
And her mom. What a great mom.
I know. Ugh.
All right, she holds an MFA in fiction from Western New England University. Her writing has been featured on HuffPost, BuzzFeed, Medium, Electric Literature, and more. Connect with Bailey on Twitter, at Bailey Jones. That's at BAYLEAJONES. You know, what's interesting about the story is that here's a woman who is gay, obviously. And I know, you know, maybe you related, maybe you grew up sort of similar or as you were, you know, it probably, but I didn't. And I still related to this story in such a great big way, mostly because here's a person that just wants to fit in, but she also is struggling with being herself.
And yeah, who, she just wants to.
Yeah, who doesn't struggle with that?
She wants to be me. She wants to be herself. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think because of all the details, and we talked about details on our last episode and how they bring people in, they become more universal, the more specific they are. And because of the details that Bailey used in her story, I mean,
we say this all the time, and in this case, it's true. You don't have to be a butch lesbian to understand, if a story's done well, to understand the struggle with being yourself.
Yeah.
And Bailey brought that to light. There was this moment where she was talking about the pain and how she internalized the pain, and then she even mentioned cutting.
Mm-hmm.
But then she did this really interesting thing that I don't usually love in a story, because I like it when someone goes down a painful road. But right. What she did was like, but I'd rather talk about the girl with the big brown eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so positive and hopeful. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather talk about mama. Ugh. Is that how she said it?
Yeah.
And then her mom,
yeah,
who was also okay.
Oh my
with
God,
it.
I just get the chills
and then,
again.
I know. And then how she went to a different school that was more accepting. Like she showed us, you know what she did? She showed us before, and then she showed us this like slow progression of acceptance by other people, which turned into her own acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And then she did her ending is so beautiful, which we always talk about how hard endings are. She's not like, hey, I'm totally okay. She's still like, you know, I'm still trying. Still trying to get to where I need to be, and I'm on my way.
Yeah. I loved it. She's just been so easy to work with, too. So thank you, Bailey.
She was so easy for us to work with, and she was so easy. And that this goes back to how it matters, how you pitch, how you are as a as a pitchy, as the editor-y,
yeah,
the one who's getting the edits. She took the edits, whatever they were. She did her work.
I know. And we've talked about this before. I'm not that. I mean, like when you and I are editing each other's stuff, yeah. I've gotten better, right? But I like to hold on to certain things that I think are important.
Describe my face.
I know. You're like scrunched up, annoyed. Yeah. She thinks I'm not better. But when an editor says this, we think this is what your story is about. And can you lose this section? You have an option.
Right.
But it's a tiny bit of a sacrifice. I mean, it's you're trying to fit into a publication and you can still be you, but you may have to like expand a little bit, like what Bailey says.
You can be both and neither
and still be you.
Yeah. So you can take the edits or not take the edits. You can take the edits and not take the edits.
No.
You have to take the edits.
You can take some of the edits. You can take a lot of the edits. Or you can take all the edits, but still hold on to your story. Thank you for listening. Thanks, Bailey, for sharing your story, and Erin Carr for coming on our show and for giving our listeners a little insight on how to get published ravishly and everywhere. If you're looking for great personal stories, go to ravishly.com. And if you want to submit, remember, find a space in one of their four main verticals: body, relationships, family, and mind. And they pay. So get rich.
Hey, writing class listener, we want your stories. Send us your best true personal essay. We pay between $50 and $100. Go to our website, writingclassradio.com, hit the submissions tab for our guidelines. Then, before you submit, listen to a bunch of our episodes to get a sense of what we air. Like Erin said, being familiar with style and content will up your chances of getting published in any publication.
Writing Class Radio is produced by Virginia Laura, Andrea Askwitz, and me, Allison Langer. Theme music by Justina Chandler. Additional music by Poddington Bear. Writing Class Radio is sponsored by the Launchpad at the University of Miami. If you love this show and enjoy all the extras on our website, hit the Support Us button. A new episode will drop every other Wednesday, so look for us. There's no better way to understand ourselves and each other than by writing and sharing our stories. Everyone has a story. What's yours?
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundle, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network. Or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.